Get started. It's a rowdy crowd. I know.
That man a gavel. There.
Budget meetings are always such a raucous proceeding. You know, it's hard to get this crowd under control when you get them together. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our work session. We have to start, however, with an important courtesy to somebody who's been here for 37 years and who's announced that he's had enough of us all. David Schaff, congratulations on your impending retirement. We're glad you're going to stick around for an orderly transition for a great bureau, and we'll get to celebrate you a lot. But now that it's official, let's hear it for David Schaff. He was joking on his way in this morning that he wasn't sure if his card would still work, and it did. So we're not done with you yet, and you're not done with us, but thank you, David.
Mr. Mayor, I just have to say that David's been wonderful to work with. He's been a great bureau director, and most importantly, he's very tolerant of me when I say, as I often do and will more often for the next several months, Schaff, can you dig it?
That's why he's leaving.
All right, everybody, good morning. So we are launching into this process. I once again want to thank everybody for their participation in the budget process so far, and now going into this next critical formal evaluative phase. I want to thank our volunteer budget advisors for once again giving us a lot of your time and expertise. We're going to rely on you a lot as we figure out how to deal with an improving budget, just as we did when we had to make difficult decisions about cutting budgets. So thank you for being here and for helping us figure out how to invest in the future. So let's, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Andrew Scott, who's going to start this morning's agenda.
Great. Thank you, Mayor. So I'm Andrew Scott, City Budget Director, and welcome to another round of our council budget work sessions. I'm going to go over some logistics today and cover a little bit just in terms of what's in the binders and what's on tap over the next couple weeks as well, and give an overview. And I may have underestimated the time a little bit, so maybe a little longer than 5 minutes. But after that, we'll transition then into the citywide asset management report. And then today we're going to hear from the Bureaus of Parks, the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management, and the Portland Housing Bureau. So in terms of just overall logistics, you'll note, and as they have been in past years, bureaus, depending on their size, have different lengths of time. We have asked the bureaus with 1 hour time blocks to limit their presentations to about 20 minutes, leaving about 40 minutes for conversation. For the 30-minute bureau time blocks, they've been asked to limit it to about 10 minutes, leaving about 20 minutes of conversation. But again, we encourage council to ask questions during the presentation. These sessions go a lot better when it's not sort of one and then the other. So, and the bureaus know that. So as you're going through, whether it's the citizen advisors or council, if there's a specific question, go ahead and jump in, and it'll be more of an interactive presentation at that point. Guidelines for the bureaus, they were asked just to do a few things as part of their presentation. They were asked to identify any significant budget issues that council needs to address in the 15-16 budget. They were asked to address any infrastructure backlogs they have or service inequalities throughout the city. They were asked to talk about their key decision packages, which obviously are included in their requested budgets and our reviews. They were asked to link their budgets and those key decision packages to their key priorities as a bureau and also to their key performance measures, which they've developed as part of this year's budget. And I'll come back to those in just a second. And as part of this, there will be no formal CBO presentation, but we will weigh in on major issues or questions that we think need to be raised or asked if they haven't come up as part of the conversation, or if we're asked specifically to explain any of our recommendations. And of course, our recommendations are included in your binders with each of the Bureau budget reviews. So just to go through very quickly what's in the binder, you've probably read through the entire thing already, but just in case you haven't, there is, of course, the schedule at the front, and then there's a summary memo from the City Budget Office sort of outlining.
Andrew, let me just be clear. We have gone through it, but we've paid special attention to those things that each of us have staked our political careers on, ran on, and that you have suggested there be no funding for. That has gotten special attention.
It's one of my favorite times of year, Commissioner. So there is, again, that sort of overall summary memo. And then behind that is a decision package tracker, which is a very technical, just sort of numbers document. But again, it has every decision package that was submitted in Bureau requested budgets, both what the package was and then the CBO recommendation. That's towards the front. Each individual Bureau section also has a decision package tracker just for that Bureau. But if you're looking for the entire thing, it is towards the front of the binder. Behind that, then, there is some citywide historical information. This is in the citywide issues tab. And we've covered this, I think, with most of the council offices, but we're happy to go over it again if there are any questions. It sort of goes over the last 7 years in terms of changes in base funding, decision package funding, FTEs, and so forth, and provides some historical contextual information. And then there is also in that same section the infrastructure project summary ranking sheet. We will refer back to that as we talk about different bureaus, particularly the infrastructure bureaus that have made requests. And again, this is part of the ranking process, which we'll also talk about as part of this asset management presentation in just a few minutes. And then finally, behind that are all of the bureau-specific reviews. And these are, the City Budget Office reviews of the requested budgets. In that section is also any hard copies of the Bureau presentation materials that they provided to us. So as the bureaus come up today, and they'll have a presentation that should be in that section as well. Any questions, then, overall about the binder's information? It's a lot of information, a lot of paper. It is all available online. And we have posted it on the CBO website, so portlandoregon.gov/CBO. And you should, if you're watching from home or if you're on your mobile device, you should be able to find the information there as well. And then the very last thing that I want to highlight, one more thing in the binders. There are budget maps as well. So in the very back, all of the Bureau budget maps they've developed for the current fiscal year, 15-16, are available as well. They may be something you want to look at as the bureaus have come up. And again, they're both budget mapping but also level of service maps. Throughout the city. And then the final thing I want to touch on before we let Josh tell you about a little bit of good news is the performance dashboards. And again, thank you. You got these by email last night, and you have a hard copy this morning, and I'm sorry that these were so late, but it's been just a little bit of it's a little bit of an effort to pull these together. We will have dashboards for every one of the bureaus that you're going to hear from over the next few days. Over the next few weeks. But I want to walk very quickly through what these are so that we can sort of get a little bit of a sense of what these and of how to read these dashboards. And then in addition, what you got this morning were the parks, housing, and emergency management dashboards. We will be getting you the rest of the bureaus later this week, so you'll have a little bit more time in advance of those hearings to take a look at them. I want to draw your attention to the overall explanation, again, of how to read these dashboards. It's pretty intuitive once you do it a couple times, but the first time it may not be. There are, as you're going to see on here, there are arrows, and there are both up and down arrows and red and green arrows. And the reason for that is that different measures, sometimes going up is good, sometimes going up is bad, and sometimes going down is good, and sometimes going down is bad. So again, the up and down is simply showing the direction, the trend that we're seeing in that particular key performance measure. The green or the red is whether that trend is positive or negative. And it'll make sense, again, as you look at some of these. So, but again, the arrows are showing the trend direction. The color is showing whether it's going in a positive or negative direction. And then finally, there is sort of the yellow no trend in terms of if you compare the two, the past two fiscal years, performance has not changed. There is a gray diamond where there's insufficient data. Either the measure is new or it contains only 1 year of data. And finally, there's a blue dot if it's a workload measure. So again, it's tracking workload in contrast to an efficiency or effectiveness or outcome measure. And then we've also included on that overall summary sheet some questions, suggested questions as you're going through this and talking to the bureaus about what might help sort of get at the root of some of these performance issues. Again, we've covered this before, but I want to reiterate this process because it is somewhat new, and bureaus in the city have been tracking performance for many years. And what we did this year, and what the at the mayor's direction with his guidance this last fall, is really to work to develop these key performance measures. And so again, these key performance measures are intended to be outcome indicators. The goals are that they're going to be clearly understandable, results-oriented, selective, useful, reliable, and comparable. And I think the bureaus have done a really great job of developing these KPMs. And as you go through these, you'll note that some of these, I think, are more outcome-focused. than others, and that may be a good conversation to have with the Bureau as well. So to the extent you feel like the KPM is not necessarily measuring the ultimate goal of what we're trying to do as a city, that's a question as well to ask, and whether there are different measures. And I want to stress, this is the opportunity for council as you're going through these, since it is the first time you've seen the dashboards. We're really looking for any feedback. Again, we've been working with the bureaus for a long time on these, but we're really looking for council feedback so that we can solidify and finalize these key performance measures. So if you have issues with the things that are being measured, these hearings are the time to raise those questions and then have that conversation. Okay, that was a lot. Anything before we dive in? Okay, so let me know as we go through if you do have any logistical questions or schedule questions or anything else. We'll try and answer them, and I'll turn it over to Josh.
All right, thanks, Andrew. Josh Howard, City Economist. As we briefed most of you last week, there haven't been a lot of changes since December. Essentially, though, those things that have changed have been unanimously positive in terms of our revenue sources and the economy in general. The U.S. economy continues to improve. Oregon does a little bit better on average than the nation. And Portland does better than the rest of Oregon on average over the last year or so. And that trend's just continuing now. As we look at our current situation, we're looking at having about $11.5 million in excess ongoing revenues and about $19.5 million in excess one-time revenues heading into the next budget. You know, as we look ahead to the next steps, really the uncertainty lies with business license taxes, as it always does this time of year. They're very volatile. We get about two-thirds of our collections after March, so there's still could be some significant movement. That having been said, all indications are that things are looking good on that end as well at this point, but it is very early. We'll come out with a final forecast the last week of April after we get data from the Revenue Division over an OMF regarding sort of final year, final collections for the April 15th tax time. So with that, I can hand it back to Andrew or answer any questions. Not much of a story, but it's a good one.
That's right. And maybe then the transition into the asset management report, and this is something that we did include in sort of that overall summary memo. But one of the things that again, CBO recommends that given the excess revenue is that council and the city look for investments that are going to increase the city's overall financial resiliency. This is something we've talked about, you know, over during prior budgets as well. But when we're looking at sort of what the city's long-term costs are and long-term obligations is trying to make investments now that are going to reduce that cost curve, that are going to bend it down rather than up. And just as a couple examples of that, investments in our infrastructure, again, tend to bend the cost curve down. These are costs that we're going to have no matter what. And we either take care of them today or we take care of them tomorrow, and they're generally more expensive. So to the extent we do that, the city becomes more financially sustainable and financially resilient moving forward. On the other hand, investments in people and programs tend to bend the cost curve up. Traditionally, personnel costs grow faster than inflation. And so, again, the more people and programs we add, the more that can squeeze in the future as those costs tend to outpace. So this is not to indicate we shouldn't add anything back. We obviously have made a number of reductions throughout the recession and then with the library levy and some other changes a couple of years ago. And so I think there are some necessary reinvestments in some of those programs. But what I would caution council is just to be very prudent in terms of those decisions and very conscientious, knowing that as you add people and programs, they will outpace inflation. And so the next time we have a downturn, it could exacerbate the situation at that point. And finally, I would say there are other opportunities as well. The mayor and council, you've invested in reducing debt in the past, making sometimes cash financing some capital projects as well. And finally, we could also invest in a rainy day fund to the extent that that was something of interest. We do have a general fund reserve, as you all know, at 10%. A rainy day fund would be on top of that and, again, could be available during a downturn to help bridge some of those reductions. So with that overview, I think we'll bring up Susan Anderson, and we'll launch into the capital assets report.
Good morning, Commissioner Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and good morning to all of you who are volunteering and helping us. In the past, those of you who remember this presentation, we did it in a way where each one of the sort of a popping heads of each one of the Bureau directors came up. This year, we're going to simplify it a little bit, and Andrew and I are going to do the presentation. In your binder, you should have the slides presentation. It starts with a slide that looks like this. So, okay. And you'll also have the 2014 Citywide Asset Management Report and an executive summary that's just a four-page foldout. So going through the slides, the first one there, it says citywide coordination. And I'd say that's kind of starting on a positive note. Citywide coordination is something we do a lot of. As you probably know, we kind of coordinate citywide infrastructure on two levels. One is with the bureau directors. We meet, the planning and development directors meet once or twice a month on all development issues. And in addition, staff from six bureaus meet as a citywide asset management group. The staff level group collects data, they share their expertise. Together, they implement a shared work plan for best practices. They also work together to develop the citywide asset report. The role that BPS, my bureau, plays is to bring the group together to facilitate discussion, coordinate and collect all the data, and put together the report with the help of all the bureaus. The group tends to really push itself and push each other in terms of kind of constant improvement. They did a formal self-assessment this year. In the report that's in your binder there, on page 37, there is a report card from the different bureaus on how they've done on their asset management, sort of a self-assessment. And they're using those results to set priorities for their shared work plan. The next slide, which looks like this, which is the first pie chart. You can see what the total value of our assets are, which is $34 billion. As you can see, about two-thirds of that is water and sewer. The next page shows the condition of our assets. A little over 20% of our assets, or about $7 billion of the $34 billion, are in poor or very poor condition. As you know, much of that is transportation related. On the flip side, if you look at the areas in blue and green, the good news is that about half of our assets are in very good or good condition. The next page shows that if we are to avoid further deterioration of our assets, for example, we're going trying to stop the movement from going from fair to poor or poor to very poor, we need to invest nearly $250 million a year. Again, more than two-thirds of that is for transportation. And Leah and I'm sure Commissioner Novick and others can answer questions about that. On the next page, this graph shows the interactive pieces and kind of the flow of good asset management. I think the first time I came up to do this report 6 years ago, we didn't have, we knew what we were doing in the bureaus, but we didn't have sort of a flow and kind of best practices around it in terms of helping each other do the best work in all of the bureaus. So the graph shows sort of the interactive pieces. You need to set service levels, assess risks, do cost-benefit analysis, define funding strategy, and finally implement the projects and track performance, and then start over again. Next slide. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the pieces of the asset management process. The next slide is about levels of service. This example talks about how Parks has set a key target or a level of service to have all households be within a half-mile walk to a park or a natural area. Each of the bureaus sets levels of service, and those are based on their system needs, on regulatory requirements, on the expectations of customers, and then the service levels are reflected in the key performance measures that Andrew has just mentioned. On the next page is an example of a service level for PBOT compared to the amount of money needed for that level of service. During the funding conversations that have occurred over the past year, about $91 million was the amount required in fiscal year 2012-13 to meet pavement improvement service levels. This shows that the longer the city waits to fund repairs, the more expensive it gets. And mainly that's, for example, fixing a street that's in fair condition is less expensive than fixing a street that's in poor condition. You just have limited your options and the expense goes up. Next slide is about risk. Risk is a combination of two factors. The consequence of failure, how big, how messy is it going to be, how hurtful can it be, and the likelihood that the asset will fail. Consequences can be minor, things like for the Water Bureau, if they had to shut off water for 2 hours for, you know, a home, that might be considered a minor consequence. And then obviously there can be major consequences of major street or other failures. The goal in asset management is to stay away from the red and orange areas and move down and try and be in the green areas of that map. A typical example in your everyday life is if you own a car, changing the oil in it. So if you don't change the oil, both the consequences and the likelihood of engine problems are pretty high. Pretty much you're up in the red, orange area most of the time. Yet the cost for doing it is pretty low, and so we tend to change our oil. Things that have a low level of risk and the consequences are low, those are the kinds of things that the bureaus are trying, they tend to push off until a time before there's failure. But those don't necessarily have to go to the top of the list. Next slide, also about risk. This shows how BES assesses the risk of sewer failure and prioritizes capital projects. The map highlights areas of the city where the pipe system has the greatest likelihood and greatest consequence of failure. Basically, they look at all the different factors related to pipe condition and capacity, combined with the types of facilities that are nearby. Are there critical facilities like fire stations or schools? And also then they're looking at different factors of different neighborhoods, like are there a lot of basements that might flood, things like that. Again, BES can provide more additional information. Next slide is an example of the 911 center. This past year, the roof of the Portland Communication Center, which houses 911 systems, started leaking in several places. The risks were significant in terms of damage, and the repairs would also extend the life of the building. So in response, that project was recently funded. The next page shows an example from the Water Bureau. The picture on the left shows a cracked supply line on Powell Butte. The cracked pipe on the left then resulted in the picture on the right and some pretty huge runoff. Also, this area in terms of the amount of consequence, this area is prone to landslides, so it was particularly important to repair it quickly. So that's just a handful of examples. Before I hand it over to Andrew, who's going to talk a little bit about funding options, I wanted to thank my other bureau directors that are here. I also wanted to thank the City Asset Managers Group. It's a group of 12 people. They meet regularly. I think this group is a really good example of the coordination. We often talk about how we're all in silos. We're not. We're working together a lot of the time, especially behind the scenes, and those groups are tending to push each other. One other area I'd like to mention, and we've talked about it a little bit in the planning development directors group. Years ago, maybe a decade ago, parks didn't used to be in this plan, this report. Parks was seen as an amenity, not really as a key infrastructure of the city. That has shifted. We understand that it is indeed a key infrastructure of the city. Similarly, I think something we talked a lot about in the past year is affordable housing. And I'd like you to think about the issue of, although we don't own affordable housing, many cities do, and they would include it in this kind of a report. So we might want to think about the idea of at least monitoring, tracking, you know, how much affordable housing do we have and in what parts of the city is it, and make it a part of this report. So hand it over to Andrew.
Great. Thank you. So I'm going to talk a little bit about funding strategies and options and talk about sort of the progress that I think we've made to date over the last couple of years and then ways that we can push deeper into this backlog. And I think there are some concrete things that we can do. This slide is intended to get at the funding strategies and sort of talk about the multi-pronged approach that's going to be needed. General fund and revenue generating bureaus obviously have different sources of funding that they use for both their operating and their capital, and therefore different solutions are needed to address those funding gaps. And again, you can see that in terms of water and sewer rates versus general fund for parks and versus transportation, which is sort of a combination of those. And because of these complexities, again, the solution to the city's overall infrastructure funding issue needs to be multi-pronged. There's not going to be any silver bullet to this, but again, it needs to be a multifaceted approach that's going to look to the long term. It's a problem that's developed over decades, and we won't be able to fix it in any one budget cycle, but I think there are things we can do to make some significant progress on it. So if we go to the next slide in terms of funding options. You have seen this before, but I want to sort of come back to it occasionally to show the progress that I think we are making. So during the last year, the last budget process, City Council adopted a budget note that directed the Bureau of Asset Managers that Susan was just talking about to work with the City Budget Office and develop funding options for allocating resources to address this backlog. And in the fall bump, you received a report that outlined a whole suite of options for closing that funding gap. Again, recognizing that this needs to be a multi-pronged approach. What this chart does is it shows the things that we are actually already either implementing or are that they either have been implemented or they're ongoing. And so, again, in last year's fall bump, Council did allocate more of the excess resources, excess one time, than we have in the past for major maintenance and replacement projects. Obviously, the pursuit of new revenues in PBOT is ongoing, and a parks bond was passed. That actually wasn't part of the report, but it is part of addressing the parks backlog. In terms of the 2015-16 recommendations, again, Council just recently passed some policy revisions, which increased the amount of one-time that goes to these capital infrastructure maintenance and backlog projects from 25% to 50%, and also looked at next year's it wasn't just the excess balance from the prior year, but it's future year forecast as well in terms of doing that. And the report also recommended reestablishing the capital set aside. One of the things you'll see in the City Budget Office recommendations is we are recommending about $3.4 million of ongoing resources from this year's budget for capital projects. We have allocated those to specific capital projects that are listed in the report. But again, that would be ongoing resources, and so it would reestablish that capital set aside at $3.4 million. And I think as we go through this budget process, I hope that's a conversation we have as well, whether that's the right size or whether that should be even larger. Then again, bureaus can come back every year and make requests out of that pot. And then finally, debt financing the fueling stations and getting that, which is, again, a major issue both from emergency preparedness and also just taking care of our infrastructure. Council had approved that as part of the last year's fall bump as well. The other things on there are things that, again, need further conversation, but these include increasing rates for our internal service funds so they have adequate replacement reserves for when those technologies and other facilities need to be replaced, developing ongoing general fund current appropriation level target increases so that we can cover sort of the routine maintenance that needs to be covered in our bureaus, in our operating bureaus, so again, preventing the situation from getting worse. And then in 16-17 budgets and beyond, again, continuing with those same approaches. In terms of the next slide, I just want to talk a little bit about the general fund project ranking. And this process, which I think you're becoming more familiar with, we started last year in the fall bump. We, again, worked with all the city's asset managers, including the water and BES asset managers, who, of course, didn't have any requests for general fund on this, but were incredibly helpful in terms of bringing their asset management expertise to the table and helping develop the scoring criteria. We did make some revisions to that criteria based, again, on feedback after that first run. We've used it again in terms of evaluating the projects that came forward this year. And again, you can see the City Budget Office recommendations, which really closely align with those project ranking criteria. But, you know, and you can see there this last year, again, the fueling infrastructure came through that process, as well as about $4.2 million for transportation, parks, and facilities. And then again, as part of the 15-16 budget process, that 50% of one-time general fund resources, which at the time the slide was made was about $7.2 million. With the new numbers you heard from Josh this morning, it's closer, just under $10 million. And again, that may change a little bit before the April forecast as well. And we received just under $30 million of projects that were ranked. I think in terms of just wrapping up the presentation and getting any questions Council has, you know, I think the city has taken a lot of steps in the right direction. And as I mentioned, we've made a lot of good progress. I think learning from each other and sharing best practices across bureaus, this is something the City Asset Managers Group has been doing for some time. And again, we've been able to tap into their knowledge to sort of bring some of that asset management criteria and process to the budget funding decisions as well. Again, pursuing new revenues for our streets, I think that's an issue that's going to continue to be there in terms of, as Susan mentioned, that backlog in terms of the Transportation Bureau. Allocating more funding for major maintenance and replacement, and reestablishing the general fund capital set aside, again, are things that council can continue to do to chip away at some of that backlog. And then keeping up that momentum, again, these are the things that are listed as sort of part of this year and next year's budget processes in terms of the incremental rate increases for the revenue bureaus, and continuing to use asset management to inform our budget decisions and continuing to invest in order to narrow the gap. One thing I do want to note, because it has come up in some of my conversations with council offices as we've gone through the ranking process, the project ranking, that is done from an asset management standpoint. And what that means is, again, the asset managers sort of look at it from just a risk of failure and a benefit approach and their scoring criteria, and we're happy to walk through. We've got all the scoring sheets for all of those projects. What I think it does leave out is when you start putting other lenses on top of it, such as an emergency management lens or an equity lens, and again, there are criteria in there that sort of give some additional points for those things, but council may, as you're going through those projects, look at those and apply some other criteria as well, again, some city values issues. And to the extent that a project that might have a really good emergency management benefit in the future, it may not rank super high in that criteria because the asset may not be in failure. It may be something that we expect to fail during a major earthquake. That's the kind of criteria that, again, council will need to use their judgment in terms of doing. The same thing with equity. There are some bonus points that these projects get in terms of their equity impact. But when you're looking at projects in different parts of town, or you're looking in projects that are have traditionally received fewer city services, that may also be a criteria you want to apply as you're going through those projects. So with that, Susan, I don't know if you had anything else to wrap up.
Most of the bureau directors are here, so if you had specific questions about transportation, water, BES, feel free to call them up.
Actually, this isn't a question so much as a comment. Susan, could we see slide 3 again, the $7.3 billion assets in poor or very poor conditions?
Yeah, it's that one. Mm-hmm.
So what I wanted to observe about this is you see that our transportation assets are in much worse condition than our water and sewer assets. And that's a consequence of the fact that we as a city have adopted a very different attitude towards funding transportation than our attitude towards funding water and sewer. Last May, the mayor and I proposed a $12 a month transportation fee for most households, although people living in apartments and low-income people would have paid less. And we proposed a non-residential fee that was based on a formula used by a number of municipalities, including Medford, Oregon. And the reaction was swift. We heard a lot of talk about how this has to go to the voters, and concerns about regressivity, and concerns about the impact on small businesses, and on nonprofits, and on faith organizations. And in the end, of course, as you know, we did not adopt a transportation fee. By contrast, last week, we had a hearing on water and sewer rates, in which those bureaus proposed an increase in the average family's water and sewer bill for this next year of $4.58, their monthly water and sewer bill. And this would only be the latest in a long line of increases. If this latest proposal is adopted, since 2009, the average family's water and sewer bill will have gone up by $27 a month. The base charge for water and sewer would go up to $11.91 a month. Virtually the same as the total amount of last year's proposed transportation fee. And the base charge, of course, is what you pay simply for being hooked up to the system, even if you never flush the toilet or turn on the tap. But the response to last week's proposal was very different. We didn't hear a lot of people saying this has to go to the voters. We didn't hear a lot of people saying this is regressive, although water and sewer fees are regressive. There's not a great correlation between income and water and sewer usage. We didn't hear concerns about the impact on small business, even though small businesses do pay water and sewer fees, and they don't get a small business discount. And we didn't hear concerns about the impact on nonprofits and faith organizations, even though nonprofits and faith organizations do pay water and sewer fees, and they don't get a discount. Now, I think I know the reason for the difference in the reaction. David Leslie of Ecumenical Ministries told me the reason last year. In the middle of the street fee debate, I ran into him at an unrelated event, and they said, David, why are the faith organizations raising such a ruckus about this proposed transportation fee when I can't recall you flooding the halls, complaining about water and sewer fees? And David looked at me and he said, Well, I guess with water and sewer, we're used to it. And that's the reason. We're used to it. We're used to raising water and sewer fees every year, and we're used to letting the transportation system rot. And that's understandable. Inertia is a powerful force. I think that we're used to it is probably the explanation for a large percentage of human behavior across the board. But in this case, if we keep on doing what we're used to doing, the city will die, because the city cannot function without a working transportation system any more than it can survive without a working water and sewer system. So I thought that that slide very well illustrates the difference between our approach to funding water and sewer and our approach to funding transportation.
Steve, I shouldn't say this in a public forum, but I think I know why we had such a tepid response last week, which is we forgot to send out a notice. You know, one comment about water sewer infrastructure that's interesting. The Water Bureau is one of a handful of public utilities, one of a small number of public utilities in the country, that has a AAA credit rating. And that's a really big deal. That means we can borrow money at very favorable rates, which means we can stretch the dollar to do upgrading of the infrastructure. What's interesting about that, though, is that when the rating agencies look at all the factors that, before they give you a rating, one of them is, are you willing to invest in your system? So interestingly, we get points for actually being candid with ratepayers about the need to reinvest in infrastructure investment. And that gives us a better rating for Moody's, which allows us to borrow money more cheaply. So we have a conundrum. And I think, Mayor, when we establish the PUB this summer, and we're going to have them in place by August so that our new oversight body can begin with the next budget cycle, one of the questions that we'll put to them is, are we making the right kind of investments in infrastructure? And there's always been this assumption that if you have a truly independent body looking at this stuff, they're going to come in and say you're spending too much. Others, though, have speculated that if you take the politics out of it, you may actually have people come back and say you're not spending enough. You're not spending enough to replace the infrastructure. You're not investing enough in resilience and other things. So we're going to have an interesting process in hearing from a new oversight body. But it is important to know that the reason we can borrow money so cheaply is because independent rating agencies appreciate the fact that we are willing to make these investments. We're not making enough. The chart shows that we're still, there's a gap. And one of our biggest challenges is that our regional partners are increasingly going it alone. Places like Tigard, which charge more for water than we do, are looking at double-digit rate increases as far as the eye can see because they've decided to go it alone. That is actually terrible for a regional water system, because we've got this plentiful supply that we should be sharing with the region, but folks are now deciding to go it alone and to take water out of rivers that my guess over the next 20 years are going to become even more regulated in terms of what you can and can't do in those rivers. So it's a perverse and unfortunate set of policy choices. Bottom line is we're going to have to figure out how to maintain stabilized rates and invest in replacing an aging infrastructure. And just like with PBOT and our other sister bureaus, that's really one of the great challenges. And how you do that without provoking ratepayer rebellions is a neat trick. And we'll find out when we have the PUB in place how we can do a better job of communicating that tension.
Need to add to that we did have a similar furor to the transportation funding issue when we were considering 19% increases for the Water Bureau. And I did not get very much credit for being able to work with Commissioners Saltzman and Fish and Mayor Adams for decreasing that by 6% by not building the filtration plant in the Bull Run watershed. Because difference from 18% and 12%, it's still, as Commissioner Fish said, double digits. So I think that a lot of the reason that we're not hearing so much concern from ratepayers now is because of Commissioner Fish's leadership and the fact that we are really being prudent about what things are we going to buy and what things are we not going to buy. So that's part of, I think, the challenge that we need to prove in transportation and to help people understand that, in fact, yes, we do have a failing transportation system. So I think your point was really well made.
Yeah, I think the other way I would second Commissioner Novick's analysis is that we have prudently
responsibly and regressively continuously invested in our water and sewer system. We have episodically invested in our park system with bond measures and infusions of a slightly more progressive revenue source, the general fund. And we have done neither for transportation. We've neither had a rate base, nor have we passed bond measures. That's why we're in this systemic imbalance, you know, in this core infrastructure. And we've got to address that. And we've tried once, we're going to try again, but we have to address that. Please.
Andrew, on that chart on page 3, which I think is a great chart, is a snapshot. It doesn't give me any perspective on trends over the last few years. And I understand the whole recessionary issue, so maybe last year and the last few years aren't a good comparison. But it would be interesting to see if we're making progress over the years.
Can we get a 5-year trend?
I'm actually going to defer to Bob if he wants to take this question. I think we can provide that.
Okay.
There have been some definitional changes over the years, and that's the only caution there. So there may be an apples to oranges issue, but we can definitely look at the numbers from prior reports.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be perfect,
give you the caveats,
of course.
Yeah.
The second thing, I don't know why there was such a response to the transportation fee or whatever you want to call it. I would think that one thing that you might want to consider is that there was a lot of frustration and maybe anger about the fact that historically the council hasn't invested in transportation. And you know, I don't remember the movie, but I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore. So you might consider that.
But that's something I think that we are going to address. I hope the mayor is going to address it by putting a lot more money, general fund money, into transportation this year. But we can't make up for the fact of the lack of investment in the past few decades. One point I want to make is that although, yes, there was more furor over water and sewer rates in past years, in spite of the furor, the council was willing to approve those double-digit increases. And just a final quick point. I like the parks access level of service charge, and next year maybe we can work on one for PBOT because we have service gaps too. I mean, we should add 20,000 ADA ramps. We should add 341 miles of sidewalk along busy streets that don't have it. So this is a report on our current assets, but they're assets we in PBOT should have but don't.
That's a good point. And my question is really quick, and it reveals that I haven't read every single page of this document, which is that it sounds like half of the one-time money has been decided already that it will go to updating assets. Is that correct?
Well, it's been committed to that category by council policy that we will spend half of the one-time monies on capital investment, but that again is a broad category of multiple bureaus that have capital investment needs.
Okay, and that amount of money at this time is about 7.5 million or 10 million or 3.4 million. Yeah, I heard all those different numbers.
Right. So the latest numbers from Josh just this morning, would mean about $9.8 million. So again, about 19.6 is the one time. So by council policy, $9.8 million would be invested in maintenance replacement in transportation, parks, and emergency management. The $3.4 million, that's what CBO is proposing as an ongoing capital set aside.
Okay.
So again, that would be setting general fund ongoing funds that again would be available every year for these types of capital projects.
And are these going to go on a list? I mean, how are we going to know when we're making those when you are making those decisions? Is there a list already? I mean, I saw a lot of lists, but is there a list that says we're ranking these and these are the highest priority and we want you to review it and pick the things that
perhaps should go up from the list or down from the list? And which particular list is that?
So in your binder under the citywide issues, about five pages back, there is a sheet.
You can find it for me.
And this is the, again, it's the infrastructure project ranking summary sheet. So these are the projects that were submitted by bureaus. We got just under $30 million, $29.9 million of general fund requests. And again, going through that scoring process, you can see the city budget office recommendations are the highlighted projects on the front
page. All right. And so they're all mixed together. So they're not bureau by bureau. They're mixed together. And so you've already gone fairly far in setting the rankings for these.
Yeah. So right. We've worked with the asset managers to rank these projects. And again, this is intended to provide additional information to council as they decide which projects to fund. Mm-hmm. Again, from an asset management perspective, these are the projects that ranked the highest of those submitted. So there's a couple caveats there.
Andrew, if I could follow up on that, how does that list then correlate to the capital projects list in the comp plan?
I think it will depend on whether any of those comp plan projects were submitted. So again, bureaus go through their own sort of list in terms of to decide what to submit as part of this process. So they have their own internal criteria in terms of what to bring forward. This $30 million is by no means inclusive of everything.
And a lot of the comp plan projects are bundled, so they are not at this level of project. They're much larger.
So just to summarize, we're going to get a five-year set of numbers so we can see how it's changed. And how do you account for the fact that during those 5 years we're adding to the baseline of assets? So, for example, as we put a reservoir online, that bumps up the number of total assets, and that also is obviously an asset in good condition because it's new. We'll be able to see how both the numerator and the denominator changes?
Yeah, I hope so. I think that's going to be the challenge, though, both in terms of the universe of assets that we have online as well as just the definitions of what should be on this list and what condition it's in. But we definitely have these reports going back 5 years. I think the question, we're just going to need to provide some information and context for each one of them.
Yeah. And by the way, just one other comment to my friend Steve Novick. My first year on the job, we spent fighting off what was called a public fight over a water district. You may remember that. And at the heart of it was a claim that our prices were too high and was an effort by some industrial polluters to shift the cost from businesses to individuals. There was some focus group work done later in that fight. And one of the things that Davis and Hibbets revealed was that, at least with utilities, price was not the first concern. The first concern was value, and then reliability, and then safety. Price became a proxy if people didn't know what they were getting for, they didn't understand what they were getting for it. And if they were getting a steady diet of newspaper stories saying that what they were getting for it is a water house, then that called into question the judgment in terms of our spending. But it was interesting. Value, safety, reliability, that's what people value most. They're willing to pay a fair price for that. And I think, if anything, what I've learned is that we and the utilities have to do a better job explaining the value proposition. We have to explain to people what they're buying and what the trade-offs are. Now, that's easier said than done. I don't know how you do that unless we go on a spending spree, buy all the local media, and then just have a weekly a column or piece. But we still have to explain the values proposition. And I think, frankly, the lack of drama last week was in part the result that, outside of a political fight, I think people realize they have high quality water that's a pretty good value. What they want to make sure is that we don't spend money in ways that are dumb. And I think the council has in the past sometimes made those kinds of judgments, and that's what gets us in trouble. And if we stop doing that, I think most people realize they get pretty good water at a pretty good value. So that's my two cents.
Mayor, if I might, just two closing points. One is, I think we're kind of dancing around the issue that there's electricity, natural gas, water, sewer. We're used to those as being utilities. We've never talked about a transportation utility, and it sets up an entirely different fundamental way of how you fund an infrastructure service. And I don't know that any city has, but maybe they have, and it's something
actually,
that...
Actually, 28 have.
Okay, yeah. And so it's something that we never put right out front, and we're always talking about how we have to compete for those resources with everything else around general fund. And then the other issue is on the capital set-aside funding. Although there was an attempt, and we're just learning how to do this, to use an equity lens, only 1 or 2% of the points for getting those projects funded were around equity and the equity lens. And so we may want to look at those criteria in the future.
I think that's a good point, although it was pointed out to me that each of the bureaus also have, at least mine do, have equity in their ranking system, so that you may be getting a double dose of at least that criterion. But and then, as Andrew pointed out, that's then up to the council to figure out should some projects be moved up because of that.
Great.
Susan, we could use some help in thinking through how risk assessment and equity work together. So, for example, BES looks at where they're more likely to have catastrophic failure. And that, then of course, you're going to want to look at an equity lens in some way. But sometimes the risk factors trump those other considerations. And frankly, from a customer point of view, I think people want to make sure that the mains up and down Burnside are working and things of that nature. So how do you balance equity with bureaus that are doing largely risk assessment analysis?
Well, we've just begun to kind of look at how to do this, I think, and most of the bureaus are truly trying to figure it out. King County and Seattle have done a lot of work on it, and I think we're looking really closely at how they've done it. Obviously, there's major areas of failure, potential failure, that you're going to always put those things first. Having a new way of looking at it in terms of who is being affected, not just by geography, but by demographics.
So we need to move on, but I want to give Commissioner Saltzman the last word.
Well, I just had a question about this infrastructure sheet and the color coding. Does that mean the projects that are being recommended for funding are coded yellow?
That's right. So we just, again, yes. So these are the projects that the city budget office is recommending. And you'll note we went pretty much straight down the list with one exception. There was enough funding. You'll see that project number 9, I don't know if everyone has the list in front of them, there was two paving projects, one on East Burnside from 20th to 32nd, the other out on 122nd Avenue. There was enough funding to either do project 9 and nothing below it, or to do project 10 and then the three sort of smaller projects beneath that. We came to the conclusion that we wanted to capture those three projects, and then the 122nd, there's also a safety project that PBOT has made a request on that we were also recommending. So it seemed that there was some synergy out there in terms of doing that. PBOT has actually raised the point that both of those projects are scalable. There may be the East Burnside did rank more highly, so I think that's a question when they come up, to sort of walk through those, that they may be able to do portions of each, and there may be good reasons, again, to sort of take another look at that. But we pretty much went straight down the list.
Susan, thank you. You and your team of bureau managers for doing this work, and thank you all. Thanks very much. Okay, let's move on to the first of our bureau presentations.
So parks.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor, commissioners, members of the Budget Advisory Committee. My name is Mike Abate. It's a great honor to have responsibility for the people, the places, and the programs of Portland Parks and Recreation. I'm joined today by our finance manager on my right, Jeff Schaefer, and the chair of the Portland Parks Board, Kathy Fong Stevens. Also joined by our valued labor partners, I saw Jerry Vierhoff from COPIA, Tim Heberman from Recreation, and then Scotty Fairchild and Scott Gibson of Labor's Local 483 and DCTU. Our senior management team is here as well, and many key staff, and members of our Budget Advisory Committee and the Parks Board. It's a great honor to lead off the Bureau budget presentation for this year's budget. And in the spirit of collegiality with my fellow Bureau directors, I will strive to keep the bar very low so that they can raise it in subsequent presentations. There are some new handouts that Jason Smith is handing out. This is an updated PowerPoint presentation that would be helpful for you to follow along in the presentation today. And I'm going to organize the presentation in three main parts. First, a Bureau overview of what is Portland Parks and Recreation responsible for, talk about our budget development process, and then thirdly, jump into the actual budget proposals themselves. And as Director Scott mentioned earlier, you've asked us to identify major challenges facing the Bureau over this and coming years, and so we've organized the presentation of our requested budget packages in these areas of challenge. We'll also share our 2014 performance measures and describe how these requested packages could help improve our performance metrics. And after I conclude, I'll ask the Parks Board Chair, Kathy Fong-Stevens, to share the perspective of the Parks Board, and as well as the Budget Advisory Committee, which advised Commissioner Fritz and myself on this budget, and open it up for your questions. So, quickly, an overview of the Bureau. We're a Bureau driven by vision, strategy, and performance metrics. From our Parks 2020 vision, adopted by Council in 2001, to our current strategic plan and our annual performance reports, these documents inform our budget development and the conversations we have with the community about people, places, and programs. Portlanders invest in Portland Parks and Recreation, mobilizing hundreds of full-time staff, thousands of part-time employees, and leveraging nearly 500,000 volunteer hours to take care of a number of things, including 212 developed parks, over 8,000 acres of natural areas, 2,000 community garden plots, 26 community school and art centers, 13 swimming pools, hundreds of sports fields and courts, playgrounds, 5 golf courses, 5 river beaches, and a racetrack. Not to mention 1.2 million public urban forest trees and 230,000 street trees. And in return for that investment, Portlanders gain a unique ROI, return on investment. They get opportunities to play, get healthy, and participate in community life. In the last year, we provided over 35,000 swim lesson registrations for youth who learn to swim, increasing their safety. 75,000 registrations for youth who learn teamwork and sportsmanship in sports leagues, camps, and other structured activities, not to mention the incredible health benefits for our kids. Over 20,000 registrations for people of all ages who learn to dance, make music, or create art. 350,000 youth and families who attended free summer playground activities, movies, and concerts as part of the Summer Free For All program. We have nearly 1,000 teens who develop life and work skills with our junior lifeguard, recreation leader, Eagle Golf program, and urban naturalist programs, and issued over 100,000 fitness passes and classes purchased by people who were trying to stay and keep healthy. In addition, we served over 110,000 lunches to youth in the summertime. We're making good progress, yet we've identified 4 significant issues or themes that will direct the Bureau now and then in the next few years, and which have guided the development of our requested budget. The first is equity and inclusion, and that's a lens through which Portland Parks and Recreation has long viewed all of our services, working toward providing access for everyone. And we have requested resources to boost our effectiveness in specific strategic areas. A second is restoration of services. This is about providing stable, adequate funding for the day-to-day work of caring for and expanding responsibilities, providing equitably distributed programming, and meeting the growing community expectations for service from parks. And part of that restoration is looking backwards, because in the 5 years of fiscal year 2009, 10 through 13, 14, Parks has taken cumulative cuts of about 17% of its general fund discretionary. Most of those cuts resulted in reductions in staff, And though we call it, I think Commissioner Fish coined the term thinning the soup, it really affected people and created unsustainable workloads for many of our staff and supervisors. A third theme is the safety and security of our staff and our patrons. That's a high priority. And as we discussed last week with the council on the park update on the Park Ranger program, we've noticed an increase in service calls and security incidents in the last few years, and our requested budget includes a request for critical equipment and training towards this end. And our fourth and most significant budget issue is major maintenance. It's fortuitous that we follow on Susan Anderson's presentation on the infrastructure needs for the city, because it certainly is our biggest need. This pie chart that you see in front of you indicates the funding we have in place to meet the major maintenance needs for the next 10 years. Through our data-driven asset management program, we've identified maintenance needs of about $35 million a year over the next 10 years, a total of about $350 million. We made incredible progress towards this year when 74%